This is an interview for the Shoe Workers Oral History Project at Museum LA. The date is January 15, 2010. This is Andrea Lumgier, and today I'm interviewing Roland Landry. Roland, could you start just by giving me your full name?
Roland Ferdinand Landry.
And how do you spell the middle name?
Fernand.
And where and when were you born?
I was born August 21st, 1959, on Walnut Street in Lewiston, Maine.
And did you grow up in that part of Lewiston?
Grew up on, actually, Lisbon Street, way, way down, almost on the Lisbon border. My dad owned Landry's Barbecue Chicken. We were the first barbecue chicken restaurant in the entire area.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. What were your parents' names?
My father's name was Ferdinand, like my middle name. And my mother's name was Miguel, so they're very French.
Yeah. Did they both, were they both born and grew up here, or did they immigrate from somewhere else?
My mother's parents were from Canada, but my mother and father were both from Lewiston, so yes, they were both born in Lewiston.
And now your father, was he a restaurateur his whole career?
Just about. He worked at Pratt & Whitney, aircraft in Connecticut when he and my mother separated years ago, so he went to Connecticut. But then he got on to manage some Kentucky Fried Chicken stores over there, about 13 of them, so he was back in the chicken business quickly.
Chicken was something he really enjoyed doing.
Yes, that's probably why I love chicken so much.
Yeah. And now it was called Landry's Barbecue Chicken?
Yep, it's where the Black Stove Shop used to be just up until a year ago.
Okay.
By the church.
Right.
That was a chicken coop. We slaughtered our own chickens right there.
Oh, wow. So it was all done local.
Yep.
Local and fresh.
Yep.
And how many years was that he was in that business?
I had to have been 5 and I'm 50, so it was 45 years ago.
Yeah. And how many brothers and sisters did you have?
There's 4 R's. Roland, Robert, Richard, and Roger, all brothers.
And did your mother work in the restaurant as well, or did she
Absolutely,
work at home?
Yes. Absolutely, and then she worked in shoe shops throughout the area,
right,
throughout her career. So.
So you were growing up in Lewiston in the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
So what was it like then? As you see it now, what was it like then? What was it like as a child growing up?
I thought it was a very exciting place to live. There was so much for kids to do, and I actually marched in a drum and bugle corps called the Pine Tree Warriors that was located right on Lincoln Street here. And I did that for like 20 years. That kept me out of trouble. And to this day, I still love that type of thing. So I hooked up with a corps out of Boston, and I marched with them. So,
right.
But that was great for kids back then. There was all kinds of things going on back then for kids. And the businesses were thriving. I remember standing in front of the Bates Mill on Friday afternoons, waiting for my Meme and Pepe to get out. When they come out of there was thousands of people. And then you just keep looking and looking, and all of a sudden you're seeing, hey, Meme. And you'd walk over to Kresge's on Lisbon Street and have a fish dinner at lunch. So that was, it was just exciting back then, I thought.
Yeah, and you could do a lot of walking through the town.
It was all walking, which made it much more special. Yeah. Now it's very fast-paced. There's a lot of shopping, a lot of malls. That's about all I do.
Yeah.
So, but.
And so your Meme and Pepe both worked in the Bates Mill.
All their lives, 55, I think my grandfather hit 60 years in the mill. Yeah.
And what did they do in the mill? What were their jobs? Do you remember, or were you too young to?
I think I was too young. She worked on a weaving something, something to do with weaving, which I'm not too familiar on the mill part. But and my grandfather ended up being like a machinist. He was fixing all the looms and all that stuff, so he was pretty active. They both started out working for like 20 cents an hour and standing in line for bread. And
yeah.
So they've seen it all.
And so you grew up in Lewiston. And how did you come to work in the shoe industry, and at what age?
Well, when I was, I think I was 13, that's when my mother and father kind of split up. And I decided that I wanted to be with my father, because my father and I were pretty close. You know, I was with him all the time at the barbecue. So I decided to move to where he went after he left Connecticut, because then he was really far away. He met a southerner, and they moved down south to Alabama. So here I went from Lewiston, Maine, spending a lot of time in Hartford, Connecticut with my dad on the weekends and coming back and this and that, to actually wanting to live in Alabama and go to school there. So I went to Alabama as a freshman. I spent my freshman, sophomore, and junior year there and found out that I wanted to come home so bad. It was brutal down there. It was just miserably hot. We all want to get out of here during the winter. Well, I'll tell you, they want to get out of there in the summer. There was rattlesnakes in my front yard. There was fire ants that just eat you alive in seconds. There was flying cockroaches. There was, forget it, I wanted to come home.
Very different from me.
So basically, I kind of just like got on a bus and ran away and came home because my dad didn't want to let me go. And I said, I'm leaving. So I finished my junior year in high school, straight A student, left there, got on a bus, came home to Lewiston, Maine to live back with my mother. Immediately, within a week, I was looking for a job. The first place I went to was Falcon Shoe in 1977. I walked up four stories, and I'd really like to work. Oh, and to this day, she still works for us, by the way. Pat Lundholm looked in my eyes and said, okay, I got something for you. Because at first she said, there's nothing. And I felt like crying because it's my first attempt to get a job. But when she seen me that I really wanted to work in my eyes, she brought me in and she showed me a little computer sewing machine. And I said, yes, I want to do that. So the next day I started work here at Falcon Shoe. August 17th, 1977. And I made my piecework the first day on the job, which back then was unheard of. It would usually take a month to 2 months for somebody to get the speed up. So I made my piecework that first day, and I just set my mark. And I just sent the message that I wanted to be here. And 33 years later, I'm still here, and now I'm one of the owners. So it was quite a journey.
Right. Now, it hasn't always been in this location, though.
Always.
It? Always.
I've been coming up these stairs. Or that elevator for 33 years.
Really?
Yeah. Same floor. Of course, we had fifth and sixth floor at one time. Like right now, we're getting rid of the fifth floor. We have space on the fifth floor we don't need no more.
Right.
We're shrinking down a little bit on the fourth floor, but basically the fourth floor was always our anchor.
Yeah. So. Well, coming up those stairs just has a special feeling to it. That's the first time I've come up that staircase.
Yeah.
Very wide. You can tell it was made for a lot of people
thousands
to travel up and down.
Yeah, thousands of people. And if you look at the stairs coming up, you'll see it's actually worn down about an inch in the areas where people walk.
Yeah.
It's all rounded just nicely. So it's really unique. It looks really nice when it's finished instead of painted, but Layla likes to be able to sweep it pretty good, so she's having
right.
to paint it.
Right.
But it's quite a historic building.
Yeah.
But we're really one of the few tenants left, and we're getting a little scared on space, so we're looking for new facilities now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you started here in 1977. And so talk to me about your work here and how it progressed over time and how you became to become a part owner.
Well, in 77, of course, when I started here, there must have been 550 employees. There was three shifts producing about 500 dozen a day, which is, 6,000 pair a day. And just to give you an example quickly, we're only doing 150 pair a day right now. But we're very profitable at that. But back then, it was 6,000 pair a day, so you can see. There was a lot of people working here, so it was pretty exciting. And basically, everybody had an opportunity to progress real quickly because it was all piecework. So the more you did, the more you got paid. And I was very money hungry because I did not want to live with my mother, at 17, 18. Right now, kids live with their parents till they're 30. I know I got one. But back then, it was get a car and get out of the house as quickly as possible. So I was very motivated money-wise. And I took this place on as a family. The people here were just wonderful. They were my family. So I really, really worked hard the first year here, and I actually advanced maybe two or three levels already in the first year. In the second year, the owner of the company back then, Ted Johansson, actually asked me if I wanted to be a machinist. And I never knew nothing about machines, but I learned that so quickly too. But there again, I was fortunate enough to have Ted send me away for training. The training was big back then. I mean, if you wanted to excel and you wanted to go somewhere, you just asked, hey, Ted, do you think I should take an electrical course? So it just kept going. I never went back to finish my high school because I liked this place so much during the summer. So I graduated, in Alabama, a junior, came here, worked 2 or 3 months in the summer, and then just kept going to school, and I just kept, every time a supervisor would get done or whatever, get ill, boom, boom, I would take over. So I learned every single department within a matter of, 3-4 years. It was just so fast. So it kept me really in tune. And then, as the years went by, the business started going down and this and that. And Ted, all the training that he did for me, I think really paid off. And it was funny because I'd go to learn something and I'd come back and try to teach Ted or try to tell him we should be trying to think about doing it this way, like reducing batch sizes of shoes in a case from 36 pair to maybe let's try to get it down to 3 to make it go faster. And he just didn't have that vision because it was the old way of making shoes. Where today, we're making 1 pair at a time.
Right.
So I was able to keep that in my brain, and I just forget the training. And then Ted knew, and he spent the last 5 years of his career here just basically training Neil Hanley, who I think you're going to meet, and myself to be the future leaders. And he told us that. When he told me that, that was it. I wanted to be a leader. So then that was my opportunity. And I've been through the last 5 or 6 years, it's been a nightmare because we were owned by a corporate company because Ted sold it. Which was all investors, and of course the first thing they had me do, I was now the president of the company, here I am, right? No training on being a president either, but you gotta let go of, 50 of your people, and you got 30 days to do it, and I want the plan in front of my desk by next week, and blah, blah, blah. It's like, whoa. So I had to do that. So in the last 5 or 6 years, I laid off about 350 of my best friends, and we were basically on the verge of closing. I mean, we were down to like 24 employees. And everybody, including Ted Johansson, all the people that trained me throughout the years, told me, get out of there now. It's not going to make it. And I said, I don't think so. It's going to make it because I'm going to fight. And I did. I fought. And I had a vision. I said, the only way we're going to survive is if we can hook up with a company that I hadn't met about 4 years previously and been trying to get them to go into the footwear market. And that was a company called Globe Fire Suits. So Globe Fire Suits makes all the turnout gear for all the firefighters worldwide. They're the number one in the world. And they're right out of Pittsfield, New Hampshire. They're a great company, 130 years in the making, family-owned, so 4 generations. But I didn't have time to convince them. Still, 4 years of talking, and they still weren't ready. So I said, we only got 3 months left, because I knew as of March, I knew their business plan. And it wasn't supposed to, but I knew we were next on the list to close. So I said, we're going to sell to somebody else. So I made a couple phone calls to a company that I knew wanted to get into the military business. And we were pretty good at military footwear. Mm-hmm. And that company was Magnum High Tech. Well, I got them within 2 months to buy this factory from the parent company, Iron Age, that was going to close us within 2 months. I remember driving to Boston in a blizzard. And at midnight, we signed the deal.
Wow.
So Magnum saved the company. And we grew for about a year. But we grew way too fast. And they had us going out of control, and they wouldn't listen. Because they're a very aggressive company. They don't make footwear. They just buy it from all over, and they just sell it real fast. And I knew their sales force wasn't going to be able to sell a $300 pair of boots when they used to sell them $60 to mass numbers. So same time that I got that done, saved the company, and then absolutely went right back to work with Globe Fire Suits and said, look, we've got a great company that just bought us now, Magnum High Tech. They're world known. And they can source the products or help us put together a product line for you. And it kind of just like, and they said, and they were ready. They were ready. Because Magnum did have a lot of good sourcing capabilities. So we got a plan together, we put a product line together, and we did it fairly quickly. And we got Globe convinced to introduce it to one of the biggest fire chief shows in the world in Indianapolis, Indiana. It was a hit, a huge hit. Now, we hadn't produced one pair. It was all just samples.
Right.
So Globe was locked in. Because once Globe gets into something, they don't get out. It's like a 3M or a W.L. Gore. You know, what they do it right.
Yeah.
So they were locked in. At the same time, Magnum's going nuts. We're losing our shirt here. Because they got Marine Corps samples, Navy samples, Air Force. Every single solicitation that was out in the streets, and it was like 100 of them, they wanted me to go after and try to get. And it was like, you know how much money that cost to get all these samples, the prototypes? So it was just money being spent for foolishness.
Right.
And we never did get a contract. So the owner in England said, after about a year, sell a factory, that's it, I can't take no more losses. So here we go. So now Globe's hooked. Right? They can't get this product anywhere else right now because China doesn't want to do it. China already said they did not want to do this project. It was too intense. There's too many standards to adhere to. So private meetings with Globe. Help us, blah, blah, blah. So Globe ended up having to put in quite a bit of money to purchase this factory to keep it alive. And then myself and Neil and the president that we have now, Kyle Spang, are the four owners. One of the owners of Globe is one of the owners, myself, Neil, and Kyle. And we actually bought the company from Magnum very quickly for a really rock-bottom price to keep it alive. And we decided to to do in this factory was, which I wanted to do a long time ago, but I didn't have a solid base. We were doing about 300 different styles in this factory 3 years ago. We had probably 25 customers 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Each one of them wanted it their own way, da, da, da. We had like 25 different leathers and materials galore for each specific customer.
Right.
We just notified every single one of them, L.L. Bean, Browning, Bass Pro, every one of them, Cabela's, and said, sorry, we can no longer manufacture for your brand name anymore. So we got rid of all our customers, all of our styles, and focused this, shrinking this factory down and streamlining it to do nothing but the Globe Fire boot. And it's very interesting because about 3 years ago when we did that, with the same amount of people we got now, which is about 50, we couldn't even do 60 pair a day. We just couldn't do it. It was so hard and this and that. We've got less people now, and we haven't let go of anybody. I mean, we just haven't rehired. We actually hired 2 people this week. But I mean, with the like 10 or 15 people less now, we're producing like 160 pair a day. So
because you can focus on just one thing.
What a difference. Yeah. And back in the day, you couldn't do that because it was coming at you in every angle. And you were making money, you know. You were making money, but you didn't realize how much money. I think the old school of manufacturing didn't realize how much money they were actually losing, though.
Mm-hmm.
How much more they could have made and paid their people. Maybe manufacturing would have been a $20 an hour job instead of a $5 an hour job back then.
Right.
Because it's the amount of waste that we had. And, it's to nobody's fault. It's just you lose it. Like even today, right now, we've had a meeting for 2 hours with our superintendents and or plant supervisors and employees. We're going to streamline this even more now. We're reducing 55,000 square feet in this building. So we're going to be really tight.
Yeah.
But 55,000 feet at, three-something a foot is a lot of money. So,
right.
And last year we made a profit. We gave our employees a raise, the first raise they've had in years. So it just goes to show how the old manufacturing of footwear was just mass production. As many as you can make, boom, 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 go, 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 go. And everybody was making good money. But now it's like, we don't try not to waste anything, space, handling, everything, so.
Does a lot of that have to do with the competition from places like China and Mexico?
I don't even consider us able to compete with those countries anymore whatsoever.
Yeah. So your specialization has helped you survive, do you think?
Yes, absolutely, that's a good point, good question. The firefighter boots is regulated by the NFPA, National Firefighters Protection Agency. Now that agency sets all the guidelines for each different standard. See, there might be a standard for an ambulance driver, bloodborne pathogens, NFPA 1999, chemical resistance,
right.
Structural firefighting, wildland firefighting. Each one of those has different sets of rules and different sets of tests that's got to be performed every single year. Like we have an auditor coming in next week, and he is going to select 50 pair randomly throughout the factory, seal them up in a box, and send them to the lab. They're going to perform all those tests to recertify us for 2010. So China doesn't like that. Mexico doesn't like that. A lot of the factories in China and Mexico don't want to be ISO 9000 certified. We have been for 12 years now, because the NFPA requires you to be certified by the ISO standard. So there's so many guidelines and strict testing. The cost of testing just this one boot for our customer right now is $25,000 a year. That's just for testing fees for a little factory in Lewiston, Maine. So thank God for the rules.
Yeah.
Keep them coming because I can't compete. We cannot, compete with. I mean, it was staggering yesterday when I heard in Haiti. I mean, what's happened there, and how much those people make a day? Did you see that on TV?
No, I didn't.
It's an average wage in Haiti is $2 per day, and there's no water in Haiti, so they're gonna spend more than half of that money just to drink water every day.
Yeah.
So I can't. If you set up a shoe factory down there, you couldn't compete.
Right.
Mexico's the same way. I mean,
yeah.
So we don't even try to compete with them no more. Like we get calls all the time. Can you do this? Can you do that? Nope. Oh yeah, we can do it. But it's this amount of money, and I already know it's $60 more up there.
Right. And so, you were here in Lewiston when the shoe shops all around Lewiston, Auburn were thriving. I think we were a huge capital of shoemaking for many, many years, and you were also here as it declined and fell away. And you must have had a lot of friends in lots of different places around the town in different shoe shops. Did you have, I mean, I guess the question I'm getting to is what did others talk to you about as that as the shoe shop started to close? What problems did it present a large part of the community who, you know, whose livelihood depended on the shoe work?
A lot of them went on. I mean, it was funny to see the people I laid off. The day that I laid them off, we were all crying. I mean, I was in tears. I had to run away for a couple hours after. And I said, oh my God, what are they going to do? But it was shocking to me. That, well, it was nice to see, actually. You know, 6 months down the road, a lot of them had jobs. They were like working at Hannaford or Shop and Save or doing something. But they were going to school because the government gave that, education.
Yeah.
If you lost your job for foreign people or whatever, you were able to go to school. Almost all of our employees took advantage of that, which was good. It gave them a little better self-esteem. Not to say they got a job that was better than here or a job that they liked better, but you know what? Their face looked a lot healthier. Because they were, if you would have seen me 4 years ago, I mean, I was ready, honest to God, ready to commit suicide. That's how bad it was.
Yeah.
It was
so
bad.
Much pressure.
I had never had to face that in my life. I mean, I grew up with these people all my life, and I was the one to say you had to go. And I had all my mentors telling me to quit. Basically calling me a jerk for letting off these people listening to corporate. Well, I had another vision of mine, save the company. I did. I'm glad I did, but it was painful. But to answer your question, I think the people that left the shoe industry came out a little bit better mentally. There's no question in my mind. I really do.
Yeah, because they sort of had on their shoulders that they were going to lose their job sometime soon.
Every single day. Every day you'd come in here, you didn't know if there was going to be a padlock on the door and your green slip. And I mean, you heard the stories, right? They were everywhere. So that's what was on our mind. I mean, it was on our mind constantly. I mean, parent company calling me up and saying, well, I like the plan and everything, and okay, so you got 30 days to get rid of them, but guess what? Forget the severance. We're not giving them, are you kidding me? You can't do that. Yes, they can. I found out through the laws, they can. So no severance was even required, so I had to fight for that. And I got them at least 4 weeks, I think it was, or a year for every 2 years they were in service, which was good. Capped out at 4 weeks, so the most they could get was 4 weeks. You know, 20, 30 years of service. If you walk through the factory here, almost every one of our, I think our average age is 49, and years of service here is like 30 plus, 20 plus. But this is a very happy group right now, because we don't have that fear right now of not knowing, and that's what was wrong with the shoe industry and its decline. Because when it was very busy, you could quit Falcon Shoe right now, this moment, on the fourth floor, go down to the third floor, and get hired by Dory's Shoe. If they weren't hiring, you go upstairs and go to the Tonic. Or you go to Billing Shoe. I mean, just in this building alone.
They were all in this
all
building.
In this building. And wow. And guess what? We would take you. Because we were busy, and then when we slowed down, you'd go somewhere else. You'd walk across the street, go here. There. I mean, there were shoe shops everywhere. So people weren't fearful of losing their jobs. So it was really weird to see it all evolve into where it's now. I mean, this is how shoe people really, really are. Okay, once you're a shoe person, I don't know how it is if it's like that in every industry, but in this, like, looking out my glass window right now, I can name 1, 2, 3, 4 people that drive more than 50 miles a day to come to Falcon Shoe to work. That's 100 miles a day of travel from Wilton to Farmington to Skowhegan to Bridgeton. It is amazing. I had a young couple, which really I felt good about, just moved from Biddeford. They worked here for about a year, and they decided to come and live here just to work at Falcon Shoe. And these people are 20 years old, 21. So I think the youth can get hooked again as this thing starts climbing. But I don't think we'll ever be as big as we were. And I don't want to be. It's more focused, so.
Well, I know. I grew up in Farmington, and that actually, there was a lot of shoe shops supported the economy there between Bath Shoe and Farmington Shoe, and there were others too.
Dexter, all that.
Yeah. I can see somebody coming from Farmington. You know, it really is a big part of the community. And I'm wondering if sort of, and I've talked to others who felt that when you worked in the shoe industry. You really were a family in some ways. The people who worked together socialized together. Did you experience that in your times, becoming friends outside of the shop?
Absolutely, there's no question about it. Yeah, yeah. We did in the shop. Ted Johansson, the founder of the company, is now wife Pat Lundholm, who works for us right now. We have her as a consultant, who's the one that hired me. That, to me, because of what I went through as a child with the separation of my mother and father, because back then, that wasn't heard of, mothers and fathers splitting up. French people stayed together till the end, no matter what. But you know what I mean? Now it's different. Everybody gets divorced and remarried and divorced and remarried. But back then, so here I was, left without a family. So immediately, I got attached to Patty. And then Ted Johansson just took me on like a son. I mean, I remember when I bought my first house, because he put all the money in the 401k for us. Back then, it was a retirement plan, whatever. We didn't contribute, because I was a kid. I didn't know what that was.
Yeah.
And I was able to buy a home, take out $12,000 for a $6,000 down payment. In 1980, I think it was, that's when I bought my first home. And then he gave me his brand new lawnmower without his wife, Patty, knowing. But I mean, it was things like that that I wasn't getting from my mother and father because of the split up and everything that went on. And then me taking off on my dad and this and that. So I had no family. This was definitely my family. And in here, I met so many brothers and sisters that, yes, we did do things on the side. I mean, there was a softball league. There was bowling leagues. There was all kinds of things. Trips to the Boston Bruins that all the shoe factory people would get together. We just sponsor it. We had our own softball leagues for Dory against Falcon one day. And it was family. It was great. It was awesome.
Ted Johansson,
and then Bruce Hanley. Ted Johansson came from his father's factory. Actually, how it started was Eagle Shoe in Lawrence, Massachusetts, was being run by Ted Johansson's father. And Ted was working at that factory. And Bruce Hanley, who's Neil, one of my partner's father, was working for Ted, with Ted, I mean.
Right.
Ted and his father, something happened. And he said, oh, yeah? So he got in the car, and he and Bruce found this building and said, let's start our own. And they called it Falcon. So it went from Eagle in Lawrence to Falcon in Lewiston in 1963. And Ted was the original founder. Today, I mean, 4 years ago, he was very angry with me, I think, because I was laying off all these people. And he was telling me to quit. And I kept telling him, I'm not quitting. You gave me that poster that's on the wall that I keep on my wall that tells me I'm going to keep fighting till the end. And that's, Ted, you taught me this way. You can't be mad. And now, today, I think he is one proud. I think he's proud of me. There's no question. He's telling me several times. Patty tells me all the time, which was unheard of back then. They wouldn't tell you things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's quite a success story because everything else is just, you know, had such a hard time competing and falling away, and it sounds like that you found a niche.
Yeah, we found a niche. We found a great company to help support that niche. I mean, you know, without Globe, I don't think we could still survive.
Yeah.
So, but the good thing about Globe is now we're able to take that product line, which is very unique, and take it into other industries, but not lower our cost. So if somebody wants a high-end mining boot to go underground with, we've got it. It's fire-retardant, electrical, everything. It's all safe. But you're not going to pay the $69 or $169.
Right.
You're going to pay $300+. And what's amazing is, especially in Canada, because I'm doing a lot of traveling in Canada now, trying to develop business there, their dollar's pretty good. They're paying it like nothing. I mean, it's money is not an object when it comes to safety right now. So it's good. It's good. So we're able to look at other markets now.
Right.
You know, sooner or later, we got to outfit every fire boot. Firefighter out there.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll be rebuying them, hopefully, but it's been 4 years of non-stop production, and we still have not gotten one repeat order yet, which means every pair we produced here, well over 100-something thousand pairs, has been a new customer. So, we're on the right track.
And is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think is important to add that I may have forgotten to ask about Falcon Shoe, or the shoe industry in general, or the Lewiston community that sticks out in your mind?
Well, the Lewiston community definitely was probably the best shoemakers in the entire country at one time. It was between, I would say, Lawrence, Massachusetts, which is basically like Lewiston, it's a mill town,
uh-huh.
was they had a lot of shoe factories too. Massachusetts, but Maine, Lewiston, Maine was just incredible. And we, if you look at all the big brand names that started out, like you just mentioned, Bass,
Dexter,
Sebago Shoe, what else was there?
New Balance? No, that later.
Well, no, New Balance, yeah, no. New Balance is still in Maine, actually, so yeah. That's all good quality names that are still around. I mean, you know, being produced other places now, but the quality of the workmanship of the employees is one of the things that the firefighters, when they visit this factory, spot right away. And the sincerity, I mean, it's just like everybody, you can't make them quit, you can't make them go on and better themselves, they want to be here. So it tells you something about this community and the industry as a whole. It's just a great industry. I've seen a lot of people come and go, and every one of them say, I used to work at Falcon, I used to work here, I used to work there. So, but that's starting to fade away. We're starting to lose our
so that's one reason why this project is so valuable, to sort of capture those memories.
Capture those memories as much as you can,
yeah.
Because right now, I mean, I'm pretty fortunate to be 50, but have 33 years, but I don't think I can make it to 60.
That's a lot of years.
Yeah. So, but I don't know what else to say.
And you wanted to add something about the shoe workers reunion that was earlier this year?
Oh, I thought that was a wonderful reunion. One of the things that really got me at that reunion, and I actually had tears in my eyes, was sitting there eating, and I kept staring at this little old lady sitting at the bench about four tables away, and I said, I know her. And then it dawned on me. I said, oh my God, that's Val. That's the one that trained me in 1977, the first day I started at Falcon. So I went up behind her, and I put my arms around her. She was so fragile. I mean, she's aging, which is good that I seen her, you know, at the reunion. But I said, so, you're going to cut my thread now, Val? And she goes, who's this? I go, oh, you don't remember cutting my thread all the time when you were training me on that stupid machine? I was trying to make my piece work the first day. And part of your job was to cut the thread and have me re-thread the machine. And every time I got in the rhythm, you kept cutting it. And she goes, oh, my God, look at you. Oh. So we both hugged each other and started crying, and it was just wonderful. So I hope they do another reunion like that again someday, because it was great.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah,